Before we get involved in the feedback issue, as a loud professor from New York, I normally don't have problems being heard. I could do this tone or I could put on the microphone. Folks in the back? Perfect? All right. There you go. Unless you like feedback, in which case we could all pretend that we're at my, like, seventh grade dance. All right. So before we begin, I would just like to point out the most wonderful introduction to this, which is Killing Librarianship. But I don't know if you noticed on the way in through this door, this is the sign telling you what was coming up. So I know where I will be at 2:15. That was good. What will kill our profession is not e-books, Amazon, or Google, but a lack of imagination. I looked through the program. You guys have a great couple of days ahead of you. And there's, like, full of content from everything from social networking and collection development and change management and dealing with unruly patrons and apparently a whole session on dealing with unruly keynotes. And as a keynoter, this is fabulous because when you're part of such a strong presentation, there's absolutely no obligation to have content in your presentation. So I'm going to take that advantage of that and not have any content to what I'm going to say. But what does this mean? What this means is it was in the midst of a wonderful talk. It was in Edmonton, Alberta, and this line came out, and people seemed to like it, but no one quite knew what it meant. But what it means is that we live in an era when we need to think big. So what I would ask you to do for the next 45 minutes or so is take advantage of the fact that you're not sitting in a library trying to figure out where the toner cartridges are, pointing to where the bathroom is. Or, as I understand it, the number one reference question has been replaced. It is no longer, where's the bathroom? It's now, have you found a USB stick? Is that... All right. So let's take advantage of the fact that we're in lovely Burlington, and it's 43 degrees outside. We don't want to go anywhere. And spend some time thinking big, because we are in a time where we desperately need to think big. We are in a time where everyone uses the word unprecedented after every other statement, right? Somewhere someone's talking about an unprecedented challenge in accountancy or something of that nature, right? Everyone's dealing with unprecedented change, great change, whatever, whatever. And it's true. That's the worst part of it, right? The worst part of it is we do live in an era where we are faced with enormous challenges, where we are faced with big problems. And this is not the time to shy away from them. This is not the time, if we're going to talk about what the new normal is, the new normal can't be introversion, hiding in our shelves, hoping it goes away. We deal with this in higher education. It's not like, well, you know, once this whole economic thing shifts out, people will be willing to spend $300 million a year in tuition. We'll just have to wait it out. Right? If you look at some of the reasons we need to think big, this is from the Adult Education Commission. And what it does is it's a graph by country. Each line's a country. Thank you. The red dots, these are 45 to 54 folks. The green dots are folks 25 to 34. And what you're seeing is the percentage of folks who have, I believe it's a high school degree, high school diploma. All right? So you can see, for example, in picking one fun, in Poland, you can see that what happens is generational differences, kind of what you would expect, right? The young are getting more educated than the adults. But I want to point out this particular line, which happens to be the United States. And you'll notice something interesting about the chart, which is the red square is above the green diamond. Now, it's not way above. And frankly, we're way up at the top, so we should be pretty happy with ourselves until you look over at something like Korea. Korea is way above us, and they started much farther behind us. One of the big challenges where we need big ideas is in how we educate ourselves, how we prepare for this world. We hear all the time that education is vital, that college education is important, that college is the key to innovation, economic development, la, 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 and I'm a professor, so I throw that line out whenever I can. except that we happened in 2010 was the first time where academic debt surpassed credit card debt in this country. And it is not because we've been paying our credit cards back so well. And partly it is. We've been doing pretty well. It turns out that when you don't eat, you don't charge a lot of things. But that graph's going down sort of like inch by inch, and the academic one's doing this. This chart shows since 1982 the growth in percentage growth in different areas. College tuition's at the top at about 450%. Medical care is only 250%. It is costing us more to get healthy, but it costs us a heck of a lot more to get smarter. Supposedly. All right? Now, this in the midst of the most dramatic wage and wealth distribution in this country, that we see that the top 5% control something like 60% of the wealth in this country. We're dealing with the shrinking middle class, that we are in almost a 10% unemployment over that in certain sectors, so that 1 out of 10 people you know has been laid off. We're in an era of great division in our politics where we're just sort of figuring out, hey, do we really need a federal government? Let's see. Right? No, I'm not, back to the rest of the talk. I'm not going there. The point is, we have big challenges before us. We are living in interesting times. I once said, we live in Shakespearean times. We live in times where we could be writing those dramas, where we're talking about regime change, and we're talking about population growth. We're talking about a massive demographic shift. We're about to go from a country with a white majority to a plurality. We've got many states in which now the Hispanics represent a larger percentage of population than all other demographics combined, and soon than the Caucasian. Now, I think that's a good thing. I think diversity is interesting, but I think it's a challenging thing. When we deal with language issues, when we deal with collection issues, when we deal with all of these issues, we're living in that time. Now, I got to thinking about all of this because Neil Gabler wrote this wonderful article in the Sunday Review of the New York Times talking about the elusive big idea. And within it, and I'll put all the slides online. You can copy and paste to your delight. He talked about we're sort of at the death of ideas, that we're at a post-idea economy. And it was sort of interesting to think about that. Now, he sort of overstates some of the issues, but his basic line is, look, we used to think big thoughts, we used to make celebrities out of our sort of thinkers, and now we make celebrities out of people who are celebrities, right? I mean, who forgot their underwear when they went out to a bar. Really, this Einstein, you know, Lindsay Lohan, I don't know. So you can challenge it, but it really did get me thinking. And what it got me thinking about is that if libraries and librarians are in the knowledge business, if we're in the learning business, if we're in the education business, and I argue that we are, we actually have two rather amazing challenges before us. Now, the first one I'm going to pick on is the obvious one, right? So if you haven't seen it, go read this lovely article, Save Our Libraries, Fire the Librarians. It was in the News Leader, Florida's oldest weekly newspaper, right up there with the old gray lady. And Mike Thompson wrote this, and it's just lovely, right? Why do we need a new library? I don't know how old, but why do we need a new library? Get those kids off my yard, whatever it is. And I know it's deathly to bring up large blocks of text, but it's so worth it. Stick with me for a moment. While local taxpayers pick up the biggest tab for America's libraries, most librarians are little more than unionized pawns for the social activist bosses of the American Library Association. Wow, all right. Today, 136 years after its formation, ALA controls 62,000 members and through its czarist accreditation program of many libraries largely dictates what books are available for the most impressionable members of the U.S. society, our children. I hear you, comrades. I really do. I was called a communist for the first time the other day. I thought, you know, it's interesting when you have, when someone does that, you have an interesting reaction. The first one is, but I buy stuff, right? And the second one is, what are you wearing, a leisure suit? Communism? Really? Come on. All right. And when that person hears this webcast, I can't wait for the comments. Anyway, so we have this line, right? We go and we talk to librarians, and many, many a librarian has come up and said, the Tea Partiers are destroying us. I got people who don't understand. People don't believe in libraries anymore. People are small-minded. People are... And I'm not going to be here to argue that everyone has an equally valid thing to say about the world, right? So we have this sort of anti-intelligentsia, anti-library feel out there. And it is very real. We are dealing with that, and we have to deal with it. And I think that's kind of interesting, but what really got me thinking about the big idea one was that I think we have a rather interesting second front that's opening up, second problem. And it can be represented by this. Now, I don't know if you know what Clue is. Clue is the next big thing. What Clue does, and I know you can't read that, so I'll tell you. You can go with your smartphone and walk through New York City, and when you have to go to the bathroom, I'm not making this up, you can rent people's bathrooms. I don't know if it's by the hour. I don't... Right? And if you don't like this one, here's another one. Fakegirlfriend.co. Now, this one you probably can read, so you're welcome to try it out on your phones. Now, you save this number. It says girlfriend. You send a text to this number, and what happens is you'll get responded with a random girlfriend-esque message. About a minute later, the fake girlfriend will call you with a pre-recorded message, and after you hang up, tell everyone how great your girlfriend is. That's just so sad, you know? The reason I bring this up is that this is a startup, and my God, someone will probably give them a check, right? The opposite side of this equation from people who don't necessarily believe in libraries' missions in knowledge and education, all this other stuff, is those that seek to take ideas and monetize them as fast as they can. Right? That what we have is we have a plethora of small ideas. And these small ideas aren't bad, it's just a matter that there's this drive to monetization. That the way that all economic development is going to happen in Connecticut or Rhode Island or here in Vermont is that everyone's going to start their own business. And I think there's actually a lot of valid, and we're going to talk about a lot of valid things to entrepreneurship, to innovation, to startups. But the problem is it quickly becomes, why think about it if you can't monetize it? And what you can monetize tends to be a lot smaller than the issues that we're facing. That what we, you know, wow, we can do moped delivery of cat food. Get me to a venture capitalist and let me patent that before anyone does it, right? This doesn't say, hey, we can solve democracy, right? How do you monetize? Well, once again, monetizing democracy, we have the federal government, but we'll keep going. This, what we have are things like this Me Too mentality. That we go in and, well, it's Facebook, but it's not exactly Facebook, right? It was like when Google Plus came out. What's Google Plus? Facebook with circles. How many of you don't have to admit if you started the conversation, but how many of you at one point were in a meeting where you said, boy, the library could start its own Facebook for Enter City Here, right? We could do our own social network. And the answer is, why? It's there. But we get this, it shows up in things like patent trolls. There are huge industries, huge companies that do nothing but own intellectual property for the only purpose to go sue people who are actually producing things. Google recently bought Motorola. They didn't do it so they could bring back the little track phones. They did it for their portfolio of IP, for their portfolio of patents that could help them defend against Apple, fight against Apple. When you look at what Apple's doing with its market, with its iPhone and its iPad, they're now in Korea and they're now in Germany. They're actually trying to prevent competitors from putting tablets on the market. They're not doing it by outbidding them. They're not doing them by outpricing them. They're doing them by suing them. They're saying this is too like RIP, sue them. Now, I want to be really clear. I am not a communist. And so I believe in intellectual property. I believe there's an appropriate use of intellectual property. But we're getting to the point when Amazon can patent the idea of one-click purchasing. We've gone a bit too far. Right? So you have this opposite pressure on libraries. Why go to the library when I can't monetize the library? Why think about these big issues of education? Why think about these big issues when I can make a heck of a lot more money with renting out other people's bathrooms, right? Neil Stephenson, and once again, I'll go find it, wrote this wonderful article where he talks about how we don't get anything done anymore. He talks about as a child watching the moonshot. He talked about, we built an interstate system around this country. We shot to the moon. We, cured polio. We have developed the computer. And what have we done recently? Not much. Right? Where are the big ideas? Where's the new thing? With the end of the space program, what replaces it? We talk about going to Mars, but let's face it, we talk about going to Mars in like this wonderful little statement that then disappears. Everyone goes, yeah, right, Mars, on that one. Right? That's very different than we're going to the moon. And we did it. Now, if you've seen the latest Transformers movie, we know why we did it. If you haven't seen the latest Transformers movie, don't see the latest Transformers movie. It's a movie without any ideas, including a plot. I mean, it's just, good Lord. Anyway, but I digress. So, what does all this have to do with libraries, he says, 10 minutes into the presentation, and you're wondering. Libraries are no strangers to big ideas, right? We moved from chained books to open stacks. Now, for some of you, that's a recent development. Others of us, about 200 years ago, we said, you know what? Maybe the chain doesn't add aesthetic value to this. We'll take it down. But what that really was a huge idea, right? What taking the chains off the book says, in Ranganathan's terms, books are for use. Books are part of the public. We moved to open stacks. Many countries on this planet don't have open stacks yet. We believe that browsing, the free access to information, simple discovery and serendipity, that is a huge idea, right? The public library was an enormous idea. There is a flavor to the American public library that doesn't exist anywhere else. Even in the Nordic countries where they have brilliant and wonderful libraries, it's just not quite the same texture to it. From Benjamin Franklin creating the library company to Andrew Carnegie building libraries all over the world to Dr. Pepper, no, not the soda. Dr. Pepper, in case you're wondering, was the person who created the first public library in Philadelphia. Not the first public library. People in Massachusetts will throw things if I say differently. But in Philadelphia. So many people say, well, Benjamin Franklin created the first public library. No, he didn't. He created a subscription library. You had to pay to get into it. Dr. Pepper created the first one in Philadelphia, and he did it for the social good. He did it for the same reason that Carnegie said he did it, which is to make information a public asset, a public resource that should be accessed without barrier, without censorship, without surveillance. That's an amazingly big concept. Right? Worldwide networks of services. When you look at what we've done in sharing information, interlibrary loan, copy cataloging, databases online. Right? Tim Berners-Lee wasn't a librarian, but he should have been because when he developed the World Wide Web, he was trying to solve, I'm not making this up, citations. He was solving a bibliometric problem, which is I have all these physics papers, I see a citation, wouldn't it be cool if I could just click on it and bring up the paper? Right? The CERN library is the one that helped him develop it. These are huge ideas. The library, your institution, your role, your profession is an enormous idea. And we are the house for these ideas. We are the ones that when we talk about the grand challenges of our society, when we talk about what we want to do, when we talk about the role of the library, we have a space and a reason and a precedent and a mission in big ideas. So while you're going around today and while you're learning about anger management, while you're learning about social networking, while you're learning about collection development, learn, absolutely. You guys have an amazing amount to share and understand with each other, but always keep it in perspective with what is the big idea? We'll come back to that thing. So I want to just walk you through a couple of what I consider some very important big ideas for you to think about. The first one is innovation. Right? Innovation is a big idea. And you hear it all the time, right? It's a word that we throw out that we don't necessarily know what it means, but we'll innovate that, right? It's like marketing. Marketing is fairy dust. No one's coming to the library. What should we do? Quick, market it. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, right? We have a collection that we haven't added anything to in 30 years, and half of it's Dick and Jane novels, and the other half is racist. That's all right. We'll market it. Right? But, you know, is that any different than politician of choice getting up and saying, the economy sucks, we must innovate? What does that mean? I don't know, but I'm sure it'll make jobs and stuff. And really? Right? What does it mean to innovate? Well, so a very interesting thing happened. A brilliant librarian who's at North Onondaga Public Library, Meg Bacchus, she went out and she was talking to public libraries around entrepreneurship, how public libraries could help in business development. And what she did is she called up libraries and said, do you have something to help entrepreneurs? And like a huge percentage of the libraries she called said, yes, we do. Now, they varied from everything from bringing in Chamber of Commerce to having some workshops to bringing in an accountant or lawyer every so often. But then she asked the question, so, did it work? And the response she got back was, did you start any businesses? Well, what are they supposed to do? Tell us if they start a business? Yeah, really? Yeah, maybe at marketing. Yeah, back then. Right. And but what she found was that all of these people were coming into libraries with these great ideas. But they were running into a roadblock so that many of the people who had great ideas never moved to starting up a company. And what she said was there's a difference between innovation and entrepreneurship. Right? We tend to use those words together, but they're not. She goes, to be an entrepreneur means that you are willing to take on risk. And you have a relatively high tolerance of risk, and the primary risk that you're willing to take on is assuming capital. That in essence, you're willing to spend your own money, to go into debt, to spend other people's money, to work to get other people's money, to bring an idea to market. And that is an enormous barrier. I was at a great meeting where they talked about how librarians should stop helping people get jobs and start helping people make jobs. And I told this to a friend, because it sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, you know, that's Twitter right now. Go for it. Right? And I was talking to a friend who started up a business, and he said, and how many librarians would quit their job to start their own? Well, we have some, right? Now we have plenty that have gone and made lots of money and are raking us over the coal for subscription fees. But anyway, generally, right? And I, you know, as a professor, people go, Dave, start a business. I'm like, tenure? Hello? Right? This is a big barrier. And what she was finding, she said, all right, in entrepreneurship, that makes sense, right? That's necessary. And that's where the cat food stuff and all that shows up. She goes, but innovation is now different. Think about all those people who show up to your libraries with a good idea. Once again, good idea can be that big, could be that big, big idea. And think about what you can provide to them that you couldn't 30 years ago. In fact, last time I was here in Vermont, Marty's over there somewhere, we were talking about broadband and the idea that there's an amazing project in Delaware, here in broadband, all over the country, where they're bringing gigapops to local libraries in rural areas. Cool idea. That's different. Because now what happens is take those people with the good ideas. It's not a matter of going and buying the dog food service or surfing. They can now take those ideas right to the masses. See, back to Comrade Bill. Right? Right to the proletariat. They can go back in and they can say, through the internet, I got a great idea. Anyone else want to play? And through the internet, they can get access to expertise. They can get access to time. And they can make that idea happen. This is the whole idea behind the open source movement. Someone had an idea, someone couldn't program the whole thing or could program part of it, sent it out, their friend helped out, and pretty soon thousands of people are helping develop and work on that idea for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes. But suddenly, their access to capital is no longer the limiter because they're getting what they need. What they wanted was the idea implemented, not necessarily to make $1 million out of it. If they could make $1 million, that'd be fine. But that's not the main point. Now, what's interesting about this dichotomy is that I think that libraries, academic libraries, special libraries, public libraries, school libraries, any sort of libraries, librarians, can play in both spaces. But we have special presence in one, right? This is the marketplace of capital. This is where we go and we buy and sell and people consume. But this is the marketplace of ideas. And if there's someone who can handle the marketplace of ideas, it's librarians. We deal with the free flow of information. We deal with access to that information. We deal with coordination activities. We deal with discovering. We deal with everything that we need to get the masses working on brilliant ideas. We can surface them. We can prepare them. We can help pull people together. Imagine that instrument for economic development. Right? It may not turn into a $1 million company, but maybe it turns into a better community. Maybe it turns into a whole new infrastructure. Maybe it turns into new opportunities and whole new industries we haven't thought of. Because every so often, those people seeking monetization have a really big idea. A couple of guys created something called Google. But if you look at Google, it's not a small idea. It's not, we're going to make a search engine, right, that searches only for cat food. Right? They said, we want to organize the world's information. Let's start small, right? Big ideas are important. So this stuff can lead to it, but the point is that we don't have to talk about someone with a great idea from our community walking in and the first thing we ask for is a credit card. The first thing we ask for is a credit check or a gut check. The first thing we ask is, what's your idea and how can we help? That's a radically different thing. Now, I want to be real clear before I leave innovation. When many people think of innovation, they think of Steve. Right? These days, we're going to see in a couple days whether we think of his replacement. But in essence, right, that innovation is somehow this godlike quality that only three people in the world can do. Right? That we set innovation apart. Right? Innovation, if you're not into the fancy ones, you know, Newton was an innovator in mathematics. If you're sort of a nerdy innovator, if you're sort of a historian, you like this guy, you know, Edison coming up with innovation. And these are great innovators. They, you know, change the world. Nice. But when I think about innovation, I think about this guy. This is Danny Viasani. Alright? Now you probably have no idea who Danny is. Danny is dead now, but anyway, Danny owns something called the Syracuse Nationals. Now the Syracuse Nationals you may also not have heard of, but if you've heard of the Philadelphia 76ers, that's what they became. It was a professional basketball team back in the 50s. And what's interesting about basketball is that basketball, when it first came about, was the most boring game you can imagine, right? It was a game of defense. What happens is you got the ball, you scored 2 points. If you could get the ball back, you would just sort of sit there and try and keep them from taking the ball, right? So the idea was they got scores at like, you know, 20 to 10, right? These were the scores that they were getting. These were not exactly ripping games. And Danny looked at this, and he looked at the audience, and everyone was yawning, probably including the people on the field, and he said, the court, and he said, this sucks. And so what he did is, I really wish they could score 80 points. So he took 80 points, divided by the number of minutes in regulation game, and said, to get 80 points, you have to score every 24 seconds. And he looked around, and he turned out this college coach had come up with this idea called a shot clock. And so Danny took the shot clock and implemented it in the professional basketball leagues. Now this had very unintended consequences. Because what happened is the minute you have 24 seconds to score, you no longer sit. You have to shoot. It turns it from a defensive game to an offensive game. Not only that, but you have to shoot fast. And so that led to being aggressive. That led to things like slam dunks. That led to a whole new dynamic of the game where it's much faster paced. Now, at the time, the television networks were looking around for things to follow up on baseball, which was also a really exciting game to watch. By the way, I quite realized that coming from New York into New England... and the Bills beat the Patriots, too. But I digress. Everyone's now erasing their evaluation cards. They looked around, they found basketball, they put it on. This led to multi-million-dollar contracts, led to a major $8 billion a year industry, totally changed the game. But Danny didn't sit there and say, this is an $80 billion idea. He looked at this and said, I'm bored. Innovation is everyone's job. I had this discussion with library science students who I'm converting over to the dark side as well. And they said, well, you know, I don't want to be an innovator. I'm a really good worker bee. You know, when you talk about what I do, I'm really good. You tell me what to do, I do it well. Do I have to innovate as a librarian? And I said, yes. Everyone here who calls themselves a librarian, and by the way, I use librarian as a broad brush. I don't care if you got it because you went to a great master's degree at Syracuse University. I don't care if you did it because you went to a substandard one at another school. I don't care if you did it by getting the job. I don't care if you did it by apprenticeship. I don't care. If you are committed to knowledge, if you are committed to making your community a better place, if you understand and see knowledge and openness as enriching, you're a librarian to me. All right? And so to be quite clear, I don't care if you're sitting on the reference desk. I don't care if you're sitting in the circulation desk and you managed to save about 5 seconds from circulating a book. Or you've said, you know, if we don't use the plastic bags, we actually kind of help the environment, and we do that. That's innovation. Innovation doesn't have to shift the world on its axis. Because here's the trick. You never know which innovation will shift the world on its axis. Do your best job. Innovate within the task you have. Don't think you have to set up a committee for innovation. Don't think you have to have a VP of innovation. Don't think you have to have Innovation Day. Every day is Innovation Day. Every minute's Innovation Day. Everything you do, you need to think about continuous improvement. That's what it means to be an innovator. Not that you thought of the iPad recently. That'd be good. But that's not the only way. All right. Second big idea I want you to think about. Participation. You are not a user. You are not a consumer or a customer. You are a participant in control of your world and able to shape your own learning, and so are those that we seek to serve. Right? We can see this in what do we call them? Right? Those people that aren't us in that building. Right? Are they readers? That's delightful. How many academic librarians? I'm guessing you kind of already hope that they're readers by the time they hit where you're working. Law librarians? Equal amount of hope, I would hope, right? Are they patrons? Do you do oil painting? Right? Are they customers? Or are they users? I love users, right? What do you do for a living? I use people. Right? Good Lord, if you were on a first date, you said, what do you do? I use people. Would you get a second date? And this is the term we use endearingly for these people who walk through our door. Right? I'm a user and abuser. Yeah. Right? And drug dealers and computer programmers have users. Right? Are they information consumers? That's another great, I consume. It's like, right? Forget about us being the best search engine. We'll come to a library. We're like a smorgasbord of all you can eat crap. Jane Austen. Danielle Steele. Are we preparing our communities to simply take and not give? Are we preparing our communities to simply be informed consumers? Are we the mall training grounds? I worry about our youth. When we look at our youth and we say, where can they go in a place where they can develop their own ideas of community, where they're taught to participate in what's going on? Where if I make jokes about the federal government, their answer is, well, we change that. As opposed to, yep, are we preparing people who simply take and do not give, that aren't citizens but are consumers, are customers? I would argue that we call them are members. This is Joan Fry Williams was part of a strategic planning. They got to that point in the strategic plan where it's like, what do we call them? And she said, wait a second, I got an idea. And she walked out onto the library floor and said, what do we call you? What do we call you? What do we call you? And the overwhelming answer, and this has been replicated in many libraries, is members. I got a card. Right? I pay dues in the form of taxes or tuition, whatever it is. I'm a member. And what I love about this is there's a sense of co-ownership with that community. The destiny of our organization comes from how we work with our community, not how we serve them. We are of the people, not for the people. Right? So, members, by the way, in Dallas Public Library, they're using the word neighbor. I think that's even better for a public library. Right? And then I had someone from an academic library who said, we kind of like faculty and students. I said, yeah, me too. But see, think about that. Think about, you know, your alma mater. When you graduated from your college, your university, your high school, I don't care where you did it. When you got your first job, you were almost completely dependent upon their reputation. In essence, you were using their reputation. Now, 5, 10, 20 years out, they are dependent upon your reputation. You are the alums. You are the ones that dictate it. This is not a consumer relationship. This is an intricate, lifelong, complex relationship of which we are both a part of. We both shape, and we are both shaped by this relationship. Participation is urgent for us to understand. When people walk into your library, do you have librarians and non-librarians? Right? The definition is those who can change the catalog record and those who can't. Or do you have members who can come in and talk about things like, you know, baby steps, member-driven acquisitions, right? Maybe if 5 people ask me for this book, I could go ahead and buy it, as opposed to waiting to see what the jobber shipped to me. This idea of maybe we could have them put information into the catalog. Maybe we could understand it. Participation. If you have a focus on teens, right? We want to serve teens. How many teens do you have on the board that can make decisions? Why the hell do they want to help you if you don't trust them? Participation, belonging, working together. Last big idea. Democracy. It's a little one, right? And this is not, yeah, anyway, we'll skip that for a moment. Arthur Schlesinger. The public library has been historically a vital instrument of democracy and opportunity in the United States. Our history has been greatly shaped by people who read their way to opportunity and achievements in public library. We have these lines that we use with ourselves to tell us that we're doing good things. Andrew Carnegie, patron saint of libraries around the world. There is no such cradle of democracy upon the earth as the free public library, this republic of letters where neither rank, office, nor wealth receive the slightest consideration. Or, our favorite, a democratic society depends upon an informed and educated citizenry. All right. Now let me ask you, is democracy an easy thing? Is democracy a neat and tidy thing? Is democracy something that is handed to you? And I know you're sitting there already, whenever I bring up the word democracy, you're sitting there going, anger management's next, collection management's right. You're sitting there going, I have to worry about toner cartridges and I don't, and my Democratic folks are about to slash my budget. What the hell? But that's the point. If you don't think about, if you don't contribute, if you don't understand at the level of this big idea, why are you there? If democracy is not what you're about, why are you there? Is it entertainment? Well, good news, Borders is out of business. That gives you at least 4 more months. Right? Why are you there? Because Thomas Jefferson didn't just say this about democracy, he also said this. That a tyranny needs to gain a foothold. All a tyranny needs to gain a foothold is for people of good conscience to remain silent. In essence, if you look at democracy as something that you are, I'm part of the bureaucracy, I'm a town division, I'm this, and you don't look at yourself as actively informing citizenry, actively developing voters, actively helping them to understand the intricacies of the issues, we end up in a world of diatribes and deep demagogues sitting there talking about the left and the right, and you're a Marxist and you're a socialist. And that's crap. And we can't let that continue. Think about this for a moment. As libraries, we are civic and civil organizations, whether we are in the academe, whether we are in public, whether we are in commercial spaces, it doesn't matter. We seek to create a platform for all to participate and involved in. We do not devolve into socialists and these kinds of name calling. Can't we help society in general figure out how to disagree in a civil way? Can't we help society figure out how to wrestle with issues? Can't we help society understand that really Social Security is a complex issue? That when you go down to a soundbite, you are sacrificing fidelity of understanding, and that is not okay. That's the level at which librarians can participate in a democracy actively. Right? In Egypt, when they saw tyranny and they overcame it, when the Arab Spring spread throughout the Middle East, libraries were an important part of it. This is actually outside of the new Library of Alexandria in Alexandria, Egypt. As most of the protests in Egypt actually began in Alexandria and then moved to Cairo and Tahrir Square. And what was interesting is as these protests in Alexandria got larger and larger and more people involved, and then the security forces and the police started having to manage the protests, looting broke out. People started breaking into businesses. People started breaking into institutions. People started acting in a lawless way. The youth in Alexandria, when they saw this happening, joined hand in hand and surrounded the Library of Alexandria to protect it. Not one rock was thrown at it, not one window was broken. They defended the library. They did it not, in my opinion, because it was a pretty building. They did it not because it was actually some sort of symbol of freedom. In fact, Mubarak's wife was on the board of it. They did it because to them it was an aspirational organization that represented what they thought was the best of their culture and society. When they looked at the library, they saw the history, they saw knowledge, they saw learning, they saw openness. They saw a library. In the UK and in the United States, as people have tried to close branch libraries, as people have talked about, we don't have the money for it. They have stood up. They have stood up and they have fought for their libraries. This did not happen when Blockbuster closed. When Borders closed, the only signs you saw were 30% off and sorry you can't use the bathroom. Right? But they fight for a library. You're not in the book business. You're not in the media business. You're in the aspirational business. Your kindred spirits are not people who sit there and sell books. They are people who fight for freedom. Right? This is New England. We know a thing or two about revolutions. We know when it's time. So when you take these big ideas and you combine them, when you take innovation and participation and democracy, you come up with librarianship. It's in our DNA. We were founded in the idea of supporting these institutions. We were founded by the people for the people. We were founded. And nowhere can you see, I mean, in New England, good Lord. In rural Vermont, in New Hampshire and Maine, in Connecticut, in Rhode Island, in Massachusetts, you have library boards that are people that you've known all your life. You have people who stand up and donate the books and fight for these things. You have people that walk in every day that you know by name. Good Lord, you have direct democracy where you vote on budgets and you vote on things as a group together. This is a model for the rest of the country and the rest of the world. This is democracy. This is a big idea, and we need to not shy away from it. Because ultimately it talks about why are we here and why are we librarians. The mission of librarians, the missions of you, whether you hold a master's degree or not, whether this is a part-time job or a full-time job, whether you're doing this for extra time, I don't care. I don't care why you became a librarian. I don't care if you did it because you loved books. I don't care because if you're good at crossword puzzles. I don't care because people said, oh, you're going to be a librarian. How did you know? She loved to read as a youth. I don't care. You're one now. And this is your mission. Your mission is not to maintain the building. Your mission is not to shelve. Your mission isn't even in having a building. Your mission is to improve society. How do we improve society? We do it by facilitating knowledge creation. We don't do it through circulation. We don't do it through access. We do it by helping people learn. And sometimes that means talking to them. And sometimes that means doing things online. And sometimes that just means being an ear to listen to. We do it in an active way to create knowledge in our communities. Now, some people have taken me to task for this improved society. They say, who are we to know how to improve society? Who gives librarians the right to tell you what society should be? And the answer is no one. And we don't have that right. We work with our communities to define what improve means. What improve means in Westbury, and what improve means in Stamford, and what improve means in Ogunquit, and what improve means in Burlington can be radically different things. But once we as a voice enter into that conversation and ensure that our values of openness, of sharing, of transparency are part of that vision, then we work like hell to improve that society. Other people will say that these statements of improving society, this discussion, is radical. I'm seeking to radicalize librarians, that I'm seeking to foment a revolution. Let me be very clear. They are absolutely right. I am seeking a revolution in librarianship, not to take up arms, but to arm ourselves and our communities with knowledge, not to overthrow the government, but to overthrow ignorance, to bring back big ideas, to talk about what we can be. Horace Mann, another famous New Englander, once said, "Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity." I don't care if that victory is that small. I don't care if that victory is that great. It is the struggle for that victory that defines our profession, that sets us apart from small ideas, that sets us apart from those who reject science and ignorance, who sets us apart from those who seek dollar signs instead of community improvement. We are a profession that is here to serve. And we must, that is an activist profession. That is a profession that's not liberal, that's not conservative, that's not communist, that's not fascist, that's not any of these simple terms that we throw on them. It is a profession of great complexity and caring. It is a profession that is unusual in the history of mankind for 3,000 years. Librarians have been debating what makes the world better, have been experimenting, have been taking the chains off the stacks, have been spreading the word and believing in knowledge. And that discussion, that conversation, that inheritance is now yours. That inheritance is now yours. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to simply continue what is being done? Because that's not what this conversation is about. Melville Dewey and the person who took off the chains did not sit there and go, this is what we've always done. Instead, they say, this is what we need to do. The conversation, the power of librarianship is not in reifying tradition. It is in tearing it down and coming up with something better. Not to dismiss it. To understand that what we've done in the past was important to get us here, but it may not take us into the future. That is the conversation that we must have. That is why we are a noble profession, and that is why we have every liberty, every right, and every obligation to think big. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes. Yes. A soundbite. We live in a complex world, and I think all too often their forces are to simplify things, and in simplifying them we often miss the complexity underneath it. Librarians, for example, do really great with trying to make things look simple when we know they're hard as hell. Right? How many people have given tours to a community member when they walk out of the tour like, I had no idea? Right? We close the curtain behind what we're really, don't pay any attention to the catalog curtain, right? I understand the marketing and sound bites that we need to do it, but we need to constantly evoke people to having the deeper conversation, the deeper thought. Okay, fair enough? Other questions or things you want to throw at me? Please. All right, so first the cheap answer. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Bring it, Lankus. First, the cheap answer. The cheap answer is that innovation is a positive change that can only be defined within a local community. What works? Well, what works in Syracuse and what works in Burlington are not the same thing. That's the first thing. And so, now, that said, the catalog sucks. Right? Catalogs, you're welcome. Catalogs are inventory systems that help us find known items and things. They're our tools. And yet we turn them around and don't understand why people can't use them well. What we need to talk about is relationships among people. Having the local community come in and say, these are your shelves, organize them the way you will. It doesn't have to be alphabetical or by Dewey or whatever. The idea about, for example, reorganizing medium or larger libraries around themes instead of subjects. For example, innovation and entrepreneurship, that's going to have people that from teens, that's going to have people from business, that's also going to have people from law. Co-locate those resources together. The other one is, it used to be when you had to take the library to community, you had to put a diesel engine in front of it, right, and bookmobiles. This is what you need to take most of the library resources that many people need. Not all, before you yell at me. But think about in Glendale, Ohio, where I grew up. My mother's still there. And they started a library. Now, there was a library one mile in, like, 12 within 1 mile. I mean, just a ton of them. But they need a community and need a library. So what did they do? They went to all their neighbors and they said, give us your used books. And they stacked them up, right? Because that's what a library is. It's a place with lots of books. And the first day they opened, lots of people came. By the third day, no one came. Why? They'd already read the books. Right? Imagine instead they went from house to house and said, what are you trying to do? Well, gee, I can't afford tuition. Well, let's look at some resources for financial aid and scholarships. Gee, I'm having trouble paying my house. Well, I know there's lots of programs. Let's look into it. Gee, I'm having housing issues. And you're doing librarianship in their kitchens. And you're going into their businesses. And you're going where you're needed. This idea of embedded librarianship isn't just with the profession. It's in your community. And you need the building? Well, the library is a physical building, used to be our ground, our infrastructure, right? It was what we needed to do our jobs. Now, we can do our jobs almost anywhere. Does that mean we need to get rid of the building? No. But it means that the building becomes a community resource, not a librarian resource. So in Dallas Public Library, they talked about how they're redoing branches, and what they're doing is they're putting collaborative spaces in the middle of rooms, and this is a direct quote from their director, they're putting the books around the periphery like artwork. Now, if you see that as some way a slam against books or their importance, you do not understand art, right? Because art is not simply decoration. Art is to provoke, to inspire, to give new ideas. It was a way of educating in many places. The books as artwork are there for the same reason. The book doesn't have knowledge. The book's a book, right? When you read a book, you're not talking to the book. You're not talking to the author. You're talking to yourself, right? But they're there to prompt you. Go, I never thought about that. Let me try this. And so they're looking in, for example, community spaces in an artistic community. They're talking about putting lofts and galleries in and diminishing the physical collections. So it's local. But all of it comes down to knowing your community, getting the hell behind the desk, getting out behind the collection. The collection's only one of many tools. Finding out what their problems are and solving their problems. So, and I got a whole book that's on sale right over there called The Atlas of New Librarianship with lots more. So, see, Catherine can go home, my co-publisher, so I put the pitch in. All right. Other questions or comments? Please. Absolutely. During the Great Depression, the New York Public Library's budget increased. In a hard economic time, they had made an excellent argument about their needs of the community in providing services, employment, and such. And they had done it in such a way that people realized as they were reducing other services within the city, they needed to actually augment the services in the library. So the first thing I would challenge is if you're in your mind, you say tough economic times equals budget cuts. I understand it does in many cases, right? And we have a situation where people are cutting fire departments and police. I mean, it's hard to make an argument for, gee, do we need public safety or do we need libraries? I get that. But it's also a matter of having this conversation with your community. So the first thing is, as you make this transition, you can't talk simply amongst the librarians and say, this is what we're going to do, let's go. If you don't bring the entire community into that, they're going to walk in and go, why are you doing that? This happened in Syracuse University when they looked at off-site storage of their books, the humanities department rose up in great protest. What were they replacing the books with? Common spaces. They were dealing with community spaces. They were getting more people in the library than they ever had. But because they didn't bring the whole community in the conversation about that shift, the people left out of the conversation caused major issues throughout that whole thing, as they should have. So the first thing is, it's not just a conversation among our communities, it's amongst ourselves, it's with the whole community. The second thing is to celebrate your successes in the past. There are catalogers who feel that when they download a record from OCLC, they have to add subject headings, or else it's just they're not doing their job. Sitting and going, stop it, is important. But what you don't want to do is just stop it, you're wrong, you're ignorant, go away. And when you say phrases like, well, that got us here, but now we need to move on, oftentimes people hear what you did was wrong, it was ignorant, it was useless. And that's, we have to celebrate the fact that that got us to where we are. We have to celebrate. We have to find what people want to move to and how they can find themselves in it. And there are no easy answers for that. It's called management. It's with people. People suck because you can't program them. But you have to deal with that. And then the last thing, though, that I think you point out, you said the exact right thing. When we have to leave things behind, and we will have to leave things behind, and this is the hardest message, right? This is where you go back and erase the comment card. Sometimes that means leaving people behind. That when we look to make this transition, and when as a profession we encounter people who have other ideas, we are obligated to engage. We are obligated to discuss. We are obligated to argue. We are obligated to convince. We are obligated to work really, really hard to find the truth, to have that conversation. But at the end of the day, if they are unwilling to make that transition, we must take a great line from our human resource folks. Our job is to find you the best working environment. It just may not be here. So, I think I'm over time, but so back to you.